First question for you, Jay, what were you doing in 1975 through 1978, those years when the desegregation plans were being developed and implemented? How did you get involved?
Well, I was hired by what was then the Wilmington Home School Community Council, December of 1974. And my responsibility was to work with city parents and students in preparation for a smooth transition into school desegregation. And so we worked very closely with the school decision committee, and I was involved and became an advocate really initially at that time with the Wilmington School District. And then we went to the voluntary school desegregation plan in 76, 77, and there were at best some difficulties with exchanges between suburban students and city students. I began to be a student advocate in terms of one, representing children in suspension and expulsion hearings, and two, working with school officials, other community leaders, in an effort to eliminate and reduce violence within the schools.
And how old were you when you got hired and got into that role?
22.
And you, Jeff, your involvement was primarily through the what was known as the Delaware Committee on the School Decision. How did you get involved with that group?
I had come to Delaware to become as a faculty member at the University of Delaware, then called the Division of Urban Affairs, after writing my dissertation on the Boston schools. And finding out that I was interested in schools, an urban agent in our unit named Cheryl Graham told me about a pending court decision that might lead to metropolitan school desegregation. And I remember saying, there's no way that's going to happen. And Cheryl turned to me and she said, well, have you read the briefs? And I said, no. You know, I was a young know-it-all. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, that might be a good idea for you. So she shared the plaintiff's brief with me, and I read it and went, oh, wow, because the argument was pretty solid. And then I heard that there was a organization forming, a committee. I think originally it may have been called the Committee of 12, formed by then County Executive Mel Slawik, I think under the influence or push of the National Conference of Christians and Jews. And the idea was to appoint a committee that would work with the community to prepare people for a likely or a quite possible court order. And like Jay, to work towards acceptance in the community and a smooth transition. So along the way, I got asked to be staff to the committee. One of the ideas was that I might be responsible for helping the committee to draw up a plan that would be acceptable to all sides, which in retrospect seems a little naive, but that was part of what I was hired for. And that committee then expanded ultimately under the auspices, became under the, also under the auspices of the mayor and the governor.
It was an interesting situation with the governor. Certainly the General Assembly in that era was strongly opposed to any desegregation order, and was, you know, at the very least critical of what the court was doing, and took some steps actually toward opposing it, although not defying the court order. But the governor in 1977 in a meeting at a church in Dover urged peaceful compliance with the order. And I think that took some people by surprise. Jay, what was your reaction in Wilmington when you heard that the governor was urging peaceful compliance of the desegregation order in 77?
I honestly don't recall the governor saying that,
okay. But
it was our responsibility. That was primary and foremost.
Sure.
We were in a situation where there was great opposition to the school desegregation order. Not only did the General Assembly oppose it, the congressional delegation in its entirety opposed it, and there were people within the city of Wilmington, including myself and B.B. Coker and Hicks Anderson, did not agree with the court order. But we became hell-bent and determined that what happened in Boston just wasn't going to happen here.
Right. Well, we moved to 78, September 11th, the first day of busing in Newcastle County. And aside from that rather lengthy teacher strike that ran through October and November, the implementation occurred pretty much without significant incidents of violence, went relatively smoothly, certainly by the standards of the time, desegregation was considered a success because there was no violence. As you recall, in that first year or two, 78, 79, 80, what was your feeling? Were you feeling that it was successful?
My opinion, overall, I think we did a fantastic job of making sure that kids didn't get hurt, reducing the likelihood of violence. It worked to the extent that we didn't have violence, but 40-some years later, the intended beneficiaries have yet to benefit.
Jeff, what's your assessment, what was your assessment at the time? After those first couple of years, what were your thoughts about?
Well, I approach this as an analytical social scientist. Rather than an advocate, rather than a participant. Looking at it that way, the results were mixed. Jay's absolutely right. We got through this without major, certainly violence, without major disruption. Yes, there were incidents in various schools, but I looked at it on a number of different dimensions. One was, it's clear, the focus on preventing violence, not having disruption, on the movement of kids, overwhelmed issues of the quality of education and in educational change, reform, etc. Another aspect of this was a concern about white flight, which was a very difficult issue to analyze. But my conclusion was that there was some, but the opponents of busing were exaggerating it. In part, there was a movement to non-public schools throughout the United States. In part, there was a decrease in the white birth rate. So there were other factors that were playing a role in a major drop in the number of pupils, especially white pupils, in the Newcastle County public schools. There were some real positives. For example, Wilmington School District had done a wonderful job of recruiting top quality African-American principals from throughout the United States. And many of them were redistributed throughout the suburban schools. And I know at the Downs School, where my kids were going to school, we wound up with a wonderful principal who changed the course of one of my kids' lives, which never would have happened under the old principal that we had. So the fact that we now had African-American models for kids in various schools, and we had some really top quality, nationally recognized principals, certainly was a positive. Bob Warren and I at the university did a study of the assignment of kids to special education a few years after the implementation. And I don't remember the exact numbers. I think it was something like of the white kids, there was a slight increase in the number, the percentage of kids being assigned to special ed. But among African American students, there was a tremendous jump. And there were two obvious explanations for that. One was white prejudice, and I'm sure that was part of it. But the other part of it was, all of a sudden, suburban teachers had to work with kids that weren't from the stereotypical white middle class background. And many of them didn't know how to do that. And so they turned for help, thinking maybe that special ed would be that help. So anyway, that was certainly one of the results that that occurred.
I remember with specificity, a year after implementation, the Special Student Concerns Advocacy Project did a study, and it showed that in the first year of school desegregation, there was a 205% increase in out-of-school suspension of black children, and there was a 75% increase in the placement of black children in special education. The good thing that we did was, under the leadership of the late Wendell Howe, who was on the Wilmington School Board and went to the Super District School Board, he demanded, after he had gone across the country and looked at the implementation of school desegregation orders, he demanded and was able to acquire that if the you had principals, administrators at all levels in black and white teams. So if the principal was black, then the assistant principal was white. If the director of secondary education was black, then the director of elementary education was white. We had human resource specialists in all the secondary schools, and they were in black and white teams. So we started out the right way, but over a period of time, obviously the number of black administrators began to decline, as it happened in other jurisdictions across the country, and what we had predicted.
Since those early days of desegregation, as a society, we are probably more integrated now than we were before. I mean, certainly if you look at many suburban neighborhoods, the percentage of minority residents is much greater than it was in the 70s or in the early 80s. But if you look at our school system, the numbers in the schools are, while not quite as dramatic as they were 40 years ago, still the percentages of white students in the suburbs is very high, and the percentage of black students in the city schools is very high. In many respects, we're back to where we were 40 years ago. What has caused that, Jay?
What has caused that is the diabolical will of the Delaware General Assembly. They were hell-bent and determined that the court order be lifted, and as soon as, matter of fact, prior to the court order being officially listed, they came forward with the Charter School Act. As soon as the court order was lifted, they came forward with the Choice School Act. And as soon as they implemented that, they implemented the Neighborhood School Act. And those three acts together, in my opinion, intentionally resegregated.
Yes.
And what they have yet to figure out is none of those three acts have withstood a constitutional test. And depending on what happens next month, I'm a judge away from saying you're going to have to do something completely different. Because in my opinion, those three acts collectively are more egregious constitutional violations than the Educational Advancement Act of 1968, which brought us here initially.
I understand precisely where you're coming from. I understand the impact of those pieces of legislation, from my view, more notably with regard to Choice and the Neighborhood Schools Act than with charters, but you've got that all three of those pieces of legislation. They've been in effect for close to 20 years now. Why is it that they haven't been challenged in court thus far?
Well, for the exact same reason that we didn't appeal the decision for Declaration of Unitary Status to the United States Supreme Court. We were going to lose 5-4. And given this jurisdiction's history, because in my opinion, this is the home of Brown, because the Brown decision, the genesis of it, rests in the
Delaware,
decision. Given the history in this jurisdiction, if you go forward, the Supreme Court would more than likely take it up. And I wanted to be in a position where there was a good possibility, if the Supreme Court did take it up, that we would prevail. On the downside of taking it prematurely, when it was a good possibility that it could get to the Supreme Court, the inherent danger is taking it and losing it. So we've delayed going in and seeking that kind of relief from the court for good cause and for a reason. And we're at a point now where there's precedent across the country and successful litigation for a weighted funding formula for high poverty schools. And I think that the intentional resegregation entitles children in the city of Wilmington and throughout the state, really, because this is not the only area where there is intentional resegregation to relief. I am also not of the view that the relief should require another school desegregation order, because the fact of the matter, educationally, I don't know anybody can point to the record and say where this worked educationally for the masses of children that this was intended to benefit.
I'd like to explain a little bit about what happened and why, and then add or twist one little factor a little bit, just add a little bit to it. So when you talked earlier about the General Assembly, when the question of the court order and busing was going on, there were some fascinating discussions, which I quote in my book, when the General Assembly, actually Sandra Worthen, brought in Philip Kurland, who is a nationally known constitutional expert. Well, they brought him in, and thanks to Representative Worthen, they recorded the conversation with the General Assembly. And in that conversation, you can see by the Q&A that members of the General Assembly were looking for any way they could, quote, do something, end of quote, about school desegregation. They were under tremendous pressure to, again, do something about school desegregation. Well, under the U.S. Constitution, there wasn't much that they could do. So they explored all sorts of things, and without going into depth on it, one of the alternatives at one point was, what if we don't, the question was, what if we don't fund the school buses? And the answer was, you'll probably go to jail for contempt of court. And then they kept going and going, different representatives, and then the question was, well, what if we, what can we do? And Kurland says, well, the one thing you could do is eliminate the public school system. And then there was some discussion. I mean, in retrospect, it's funny. At the time, it wasn't so funny. It was real. They were looking for anything. Now, fast forward. So over time, these same pressures, which come not only from suburban white resistance, but to some extent from, I think, from some African-American resistance to quote, busing, or the redistribution of kids over city lines, city suburban lines, has led to some of these other bills that Jay notes. That's absolutely on target. I think each one of those has had an impact. The one point I would add, though, is there's tremendous support in the African-American community, not just here, but throughout the United States, for charter schools. And so I'm really not trying to, quote, blame the victim at all. I just, that's part of the reality, that most parents don't want to send their kids outside their neighborhood except for really, really great schools. That's part of what has happened in Newcastle County. We've given people an option, and they've, to some extent, segregated themselves.
Putting ourselves where we are right now in October of 2016. Earlier this year, the Wilmington Education Improvement Commission, which was appointed by Governor Markell, came up with a very extensive report, recommended significant changes, moving schools out of the Christina District into the Red Clay District, and also talking about weighted funding to provide additional funds to low-income, high-poverty, high-minority schools. It didn't get through the General Assembly. It's not, the plan isn't dead yet, but it's in limbo, certainly until January or later. What do you see as being the most appropriate, most workable system for the future of public education in Wilmington and in Newcastle County. Go ahead, Jay.
Well, in December, I'll have 42 years in the arena. And quite frankly, I want to get out of the arena as badly as some of the elected officials and some of the school officials want me out of it. But I'm not getting out until, one, there's a reduction in the number of districts in the city of Wilmington. It is absurd to have the city of Wilmington exposed to four different school districts. Two, the city of Wilmington as a city cannot continue to be the only city in the United States of America which has no responsibility and no authority over the educational destiny of its own children. And three, if we're going to keep these high poverty segregated schools, we're going to have to provide the resources necessary to appropriately educate these children. So the General Assembly, in its wisdom, or lack thereof, what they said was, we'll pass this through the House, but there's no obligation for funding. And we're looking at the potential of $15 million, and we're not going to provide that. Well, they can keep that little $15 million. Because if you look across the river, the New Jersey Supreme Court ordered the New Jersey General Assembly to provide $500 million for high poverty schools. Now, they haven't got the money yet, but that court order is there, and I think there's precedent in other jurisdictions, Connecticut. And so at the end of the day, there's never been any goodwill on the part of the Delaware General Assembly for black children, children of color in the city of Wilmington, and nothing is going to change until such time as a judge or judges compels them to do so.
Jeff, what do you see as the solution, if there is a solution here?
I think you have to think of it as two different components. You have the in-school and you have the out-of-school. I've looked at research for decades, trying to find the answer, the solution, the panacea, and it's not there. The research literature, every time a new idea comes up, we all get very excited about it. It aggravates a lot of teachers because it's something else coming down the road. And it confounds administrators. But unfortunately, in the research literature, there just isn't a factor that is a universal factor. I'm not saying they're not great schools that help minority kids or kids from poorer backgrounds or backgrounds where they have less parental education. There's some wonderful schools. But the factors that seem to matter differ in different places of the country, in different circumstances, et cetera. My own view is I think preschool education, solid preschool education helps. I think there's some good evidence on that. And I think that having great teachers helps. There's a profound statement for you. But even there, we have trouble figuring out a priori what's a great teacher. We have trouble helping to make a great teacher, develop a great teacher. There's a lot more we need to know there. So that's a problem. It's unclear that with our current knowledge that schools can overcome other kinds of issues in society. I wish they could, and I've been working for decades to try to find the answers. Now that said, then I think we also have to look at factors outside of schools. And some of that has improved. For example, when I began this work, there were actually census blocks, census areas in the suburbs without any African American families. None. Zero. Well, that's totally changed. In fact, I remember informing Paul Fine, then the president of the state school board at one point, I remember telling him, Paul, there are now more African American students or minority students in the suburbs than there are in the city of Wilmington. And this was a long time ago. So the demographics have really changed. And part of the reason they've changed is because we have more and more minorities, not only African Americans, but others, who are succeeding in society. And in at least in terms of education and earning a decent living or a good living. And they're moving into the suburbs. That doesn't account for it all, of course, but that's partly what's going on. So the opening up of various professions, the increasing attempt to have diversity in our colleges and universities, it's clear there are a number of factors going on. We need to build upon those and take even greater action, for example, greater job opportunities for people. So I see a number of things that need to be done, but any alternative is, in my view, in my experience, not going to be a panacea. So I do believe that what Jay said and what the Wilmington Schools Commission has come forward for would be a step forward. But I would warn all of us that while that could well help, it is not going to, quote, solve the problem, end quote.
And so I guess the best thing that we can hope for is that three other people are not sitting around a table having the same discussion 20 or 30 years from now.
Well, I'm very hopeful about that, and I'll tell you why. It's kind of for an interesting reason. When I was in high school, I was on the debating team, and the topic in one of my years was resolved the federal government should adopt a program to help public schools throughout the United States with financing the schools, or something to that effect. And I did a lot of research at the time on what was going on. And when I did that, I saw that there was a religious group that was not doing very well in the U.S., and those were Catholics. And I remember saying, gee, that's interesting. I didn't know that. They just were not accomplishing as much in school, in colleges, et cetera. I don't remember the exact data, but that was true then. Well, if you look now, they're very, very successful across the board. So I know it's not a matter of color, it's a matter of religion, and I know there are various reasons why. But we do have experience with some groups over time, if not many groups, over time doing better. So I think there is that possibility there, but I can't disagree with the number of things that Jay said about the prejudice that leads to the General Assembly in Delaware and elsewhere not necessarily doing the right thing. This will be an increasing problem if this continues, because a larger and larger percentage of our students are going to be minorities, whether you're talking about public or non-public schools or whatever.
Jay, I'll give you the last word.
Well, the harsh fact of the matter is, as a state, we should be ashamed of ourselves, of what we're doing across the board educationally. And you can look at the enrollment at the University of Delaware, and you can look at the enrollment at Delaware State University. Why is it that the majority of students at both institutions are not from the state of Delaware? And if we were doing what we needed to do, what we're supposed to be doing for our own children educationally, the results there would be completely different. Mm-hmm. Regrettably, in my view, President Johnson's war on poverty has ended up being a war on people in poverty. It's a systemic problem nationwide, and those impacted the most about it, or from it as a result of it, are children. And you look right now, you expect these parents who were miseducated in the school system to be able to effectively and appropriately help their children become educated. So from where I sit, I said the things that I want to accomplish before I leave the arena, but I don't think I'll live to see fairness in the school system. And it's why it's important that younger people have begun to step in and play a role. As a nation, though, and I remember hearing tears in Judge Williams' voice when it became clear that Barack Obama was going to be president of the United States. And he said, I never thought I'd live to see it, but that was part of the reason for these school desegregation orders across the country. We as lawyers felt that if young America grew up together, prejudice and racial hatred would go away, and that one day we'd end up with a black president. So, not for school desegregation orders across the country, Barack Obama, in my opinion, would not be president of the United States, so there's still hope. But there's a lot of work to do. There's going to have to be a lot of advocacy. And as those of us who have been on the battlefield begin to step off, I'm excited about the potential of new leadership stepping forward and stepping in. Dr. Raphael is absolutely correct. 20 years from now, the majority of Delawareans will probably be minorities. And I hope, and I don't think that once the majority turns to majority, that we'll mistreat other folks as badly as we've been mistreated.